And we are live, Friday Night Feels! I'm so excited! And tonight, I'm so excited. I have an amazing guest for us to get to know tonight. So for those of you who are joining us, my name is Patrick Manette. I'm a licensed mental health counselor. And this is Friday Night Feels, which is a show that I started in March or April 2020. It seems like a lifetime ago. And it's turned into like one of the most amazing adventures of being able to meet with people from all around the world who have different experiences, stories, hardships, professional experiences. And as I've said before, it's been one of the most humbling and amazing adventures to be able to meet these incredible people. And tonight we have a new member of the Friday Night Feels crew who's joining us for the first time. I'd like to introduce to you Richard Capriola, who has been a mental health and substance abuse counselor for over two decades. He recently retired from Menninger Clinic in Houston, Texas, where for over a decade, he has treated adolescents and adults diagnosed with mental health and substance abuse disorders. He is the author of The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse. So welcome, Rick. I'm so excited to have you join us tonight.
Oh, thank you, Patrick. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk about this subject with you. So I just want to take a few seconds here to say thank you for hosting this interview and allowing us to talk about this topic.
Sure. And Rick and I were talking a little briefly of it's just a small world because we're both mental health and substance abuse counselors. I was telling him how excited I am to have him on here to be able to share his experience and also this amazing resource that he's put together to that I'm looking forward to getting into to help families overall really deal with this epidemic of addiction and have a resource that's easily accessible to help families. I'm assuming just sort of feel like they have some hope, some guidance and a direction in dealing with this really intense issue and life-altering change of addiction.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's very well said. This is a topic that I think many families, many parents want to shy away from. They want to assume it won't happen to their child, because it can be a scary subject. But my point is knowledge is power. And the more knowledge that we can give to parents, the more empowered they will feel to be able to deal with this issue in the event that they're confronted with it. Not to become paranoid about it, but to become educated and informed and better prepared.
Right. And I think that's so important. I was actually thinking about as I was preparing for tonight of, how, you know, what I've seen in my experience of the different types of parents, where there's some who really go into that fear, where they can go into the paranoia. Then you have some who completely avoid and pretend that it doesn't exist. And then you sort of have like the Goldilocks where it's in the middle of, they're trying to be, you know, help their kids, but they don't know what to do. It's scary. They, like you said, I love that phrase that they're in shock that this could actually happen to them.
Yeah, and it becomes a crisis. Yes. And because they haven't been informed about what to do, where to go, what do I do? It's just all of a sudden, okay, now I'm in this crisis. Where do I turn? Who do I go to? What kind of test do I get? What do I do next? And it's almost like they panic. Right. So the whole purpose of my book is to calm them down, give them information so that they feel like if they're confronted with this, they have a game plan. They know what to do.
Okay, great. So could you tell me a little bit of about the history of the book and how you came to writing it and everything?
Yeah, when I was at Menninger Clinic, Patrick, I worked with both adolescents and adults who were diagnosed with mental health and substance abuse disorders. Okay. And so many times I would sit across from a family and I would go through the history of their child's substances, what they'd used, when they began, how often they used, and I would give them a diagnosis of a substance use disorder. Okay. And sometimes they would look across at me and they would say, I had no idea this was going on. Wow. Or if they did suspect their child was using a substance, they might say, well, I sort of thought something was going on, but I didn't know it was this bad. Mm. Now, these are good parents. They're good parents doing the best job they can. And then they're confronted with this crisis. they didn't know the warning signs because nobody told them what to look for.
Right.
So when I left Menninger, I wanted to write a resource that would give parents the basic information on adolescent substance abuse. And I wanted to pack it into a book that would be very short. It runs a little over 100 pages because I know parents don't have a lot of time to read volumes of information.
Right. Right.
So I wanted the chapters to be short, but informative.
Right.
And I wanted to make sure we covered the full range of topics that I think parents will benefit from knowing about.
Right. Oh, that sounds wonderful. Sounds like a great resource because it's also overwhelming. I don't know about you, but normally when I'm confronted with something, the first thing that I do is I go to the internet, which is probably the worst thing you can really do because I've, you know, WebMD, I've probably died about 15 times so far in my life. So I've learned to, you know, and I think with in my professional experience and even with friends and family who are parents, I think one of the biggest things is the fear of, you know, the guilt of how did I not see this?
Yeah.
They question their parenting, even though the child may have been amazing at hiding it.
Yeah.
And the fear that will this take my child's life?
That is so true. And these parents go through this, these emotions of, you know, how did I miss the warning signs? What kind of a parent am I? How did this happen? What could I have done to prevent it? And then they get angry, they get anxious, they get afraid, they go through a whole range of emotions. And I think just by having the information, the knowledge will help calm that down a little bit to know that there are things you can do in a situation like this. There are people you can turn to. There are assessments that you can get done. There are treatment options out there. And the bottom line is, we know that treatment works. Hope is a big part of this book. Mm-hmm. Treatment works. You and your family can overcome this and get beyond it.
And what do you see in your experiences, in addition to maybe just not knowing, some of the resistance or some of the obstacles for people to actually receive this treatment in wherever they may be?
I think the biggest obstacle is finances. Mm-hmm. I think lack of medical care, lack of insufficient insurance, because, you know, many treatment programs, if you're looking at a residential component for a child that might have a very serious substance abuse issue or a very serious underlying mental health diagnosis, you may be looking at a residential treatment program that could run weeks, if not months, and that can become very expensive.
Right.
Outpatient programs, which kids can do very well in if it's appropriate. Those certainly are less expensive. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the barriers is just the finances, being able to afford the treatment. That
right.
can be a challenge for many families.
Right. I also see, and I know you're in Texas, so it's totally different geographically. But I know, like in my area, we don't really have a strong public transportation system. So even if they have, you know, access to the treatment, that's one of the obstacles I've seen of how do we actually get them there? Because also if they're underage, they need the parents, you know, for all of for permission. But if parents are working or they have other kids they have to take to, sometimes managing that to get the individual into actual treatment, that it's a hardship.
It is, and transportation can be a barrier.
Yes.
As well as everything else that the family is going through. And that puts the parents under even more stress. How do I get my child to treatment? How do I get them to all these appointments? How do I manage what else is going on in the family? And that brings up a very excellent point is that this child addiction, child substance abuse affects the entire family system. Mm-hmm. It's not just the child.
Right.
And many times the entire family needs treatment, not just the child that's using a substance, but the entire family needs treatment.
Right. And how do you address that? Just because I've seen, you know, in some cases, families are really supportive and they're there to fight along with the individual, but you also see some where, there's more anger there of this is your problem, not my problem.
Yeah, it's, unfortunately, some parents come in with the attitude of just fix the kid.
Right.
You know, yes. Just fix the kid. If you can fix the kid, everything will be fine. Yes, and they don't want to look at their own issues, or they don't want to look at the family dynamics, which does complicate the child's treatment and make it much more difficult.
Right, right. And one of the things that I have seen, and I'd be interested to get your experience of, is when I was in outpatient clinics for a while. One of the components that I was surprised that wasn't included in the intake was actually a family history of not so much even there, we would ask about general, but never specific of what is the impact of addiction multi-generationally.
Yeah.
And how that can affect the kid, the adolescent or the young or the adult.
And you're absolutely right. A psychosocial assessment and history is extremely important. When I was at Menninger, we had an entire team that was devoted to helping these children or these adults. There was a psychiatrist on the team. There was a social worker on the team. There was a psychologist on the team. There was an addictions counselor on the team. And we all worked as a multidisciplinary team. And the social worker's primary responsibility was to work with the family. And one of the first things that they did after an adolescent or an adult came into the hospital was get that psychosocial history, that history of the family and what's been going on with the family and get a good view of the family dynamics, as well as any history of say substance abuse that might have been in the family.
Mm-hmm. I love that of it isn't just, as you said, that challenges that old belief of fix the kid. He's the problem. It's looking at it holistically, systematically of how do we support the individual, but how do we support the whole family, as you said, because it's a web, right? It's the family web. It affects everyone.
It does. It's a disease that affects not just the person who's abusing the substance, but it affects the entire family system. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, many times the family needs treatment itself. Right. And if it doesn't need treatment, it certainly needs a lot of support.
Right. And I think what it sounds like what this book offers and in your experiences is that insight and that compassion of saying you're not alone in this battle.
Yeah.
And I think as a parent, I'm not a parent, but I've worked with enough and I have a lot of amazing friends who are amazing parents of that being so terrified that their child has fallen into this.
Well, I've worked with so many parents who are going through this crisis that in addition to writing this education book that I have, I also wrote a parent workbook that goes along with it.
Wow. Okay.
And this parent workbook allows parents to go through a number of exercises where they talk about the emotions that they're going through. They talk about the things that they've tried in the past with their child that haven't worked. They write a letter to their child. They don't have to share it with their child, mm-hmm. but they write a letter to their child talking about how all of this is affecting them as a parent. So I wanted this brief workbook to be available. I think it's best used in consultation with a professional like yourself, mm-hmm. where they can go through the exercises. It's a very brief workbook. They can go through the exercises and they can sit down with somebody like yourself, or it could even be a good friend of the family or a social worker or a mm-hmm. counselor, and use that workbook to get feedback. I think that's the best way to use this workbook. Right.
So that would be excellent for clinicians to have in their offices, just to be able to pull out and say, hey, let's do this together. Let's go through this as a manual, A to Z, to make sure that we're covering everything. It sounds like that would be a wonderful resource for them.
I think it would be if you're a clinician and you're working with a parent or a family who's dealing with a child who's using substances.
Right.
I think this workbook would be an excellent opportunity to give to them and say, let's do some of these exercises together, or you go ahead and do some of these exercises at home and then bring them back in the next session and we'll process it together.
Right.
I think that can be a very, very powerful exercise for these parents.
That would be amazing. And as you know, all of us in the human services, I think we all love a good workbook. So I'm sure everyone's eye just kind of lit up of like, oh, great. Because you're always, when you're in this field, one of the things that I didn't anticipate is how much that component of being an advocate becomes alive in you.
Yeah.
And even though they talk about it in grad school, when you all of a sudden are working with a family and an individual who's struggling with this, no matter how severe the addiction is, all you can really see is, one of the things that I always tell people is that I see by the addiction, I see you are fighting this.
Yeah.
And you have that hope, like you said, for them.
And I think another thing that this workbook does from the therapist's point of view is it communicates to the parent, I understand what you're going through. I know you're going through this difficult time, and I have a resource for you. So in a way, simply by offering the resource, you've acknowledged that you see the crisis that they're in as well.
Right. And what I like about what you're saying is, you've written it for the everyday person.
Yes.
And
yes.
That's one of the struggles I have with a lot of resources in the human service field is they're written like, I don't know if VCR instructions are even relevant because most people don't have VCRs anymore, but you know, microwave instructions, I think we still use those, where unless you're in the field, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, and it becomes complicated, and it becomes work, and yes. And pretty soon you give somebody a workbook that's 100 or 200 pages long, filled with a bunch of exercises. They don't have time to do. They're going through a crisis.
Right.
They need something that is short and concise, but yet addresses some of the issues that they're going through, and at least gives them an opportunity to put down in writing how they're feeling and what's going on.
Right. And I love that component because so many people struggle with their feelings.
They do. And a part of this workbook is on communication. Part of it has the simple idea that we're pretty good at listening to each other's words when we talk and when mm-hmm. we listen, but we're not so good at listening to the feelings behind the mm-hmm. words. Mm-hmm. So part of this workbook tries to help parents learn the skill of listening to their child's feelings, not just their words. Mm-hmm. And I emphasize that this is a skill that every parent can practice and learn. So mm. when you're talking to your child, you're hearing not just their words, you're hearing their feelings. Oh, and there's another brief exercise on how to deal with anxiety, pretty much through slow breathing.
Okay. Well, and that sounds so helpful for parents who worry about this all of the time. And over the last few years, especially with COVID and the increase of mental health and substance use yeah. related issues, that anxiety and that stress and that tension is even heightened more
yes.
than it was previously. That's what I'm finding anyway.
No, that's absolutely true. I think, you know, this COVID, which has been going on for quite a long period of time, mm-hmm. I think we're just now beginning to see some of the mental health effects that it's had on children
yes.
as well as adults.
Yes. Now, one of the things that I wanted to go into, because I know you, I believe you cover this in your book, is if you could talk a little bit about what substances you're seeing, yeah. you know, because I know they change. And what would be something that you think parents should be aware of?
Well, I think this is so important that in my book, I have a brief chapter on the various street drugs that are out there. Most parents know about alcohol and marijuana, mm-hmm. but they may not know about some of the other street drugs that are out there. So this book gives a very brief overview on those street drugs. There's a chapter devoted to each one of the different classification of drugs. Kids are still attracted to marijuana and alcohol. Those are still the two primary substances being used by teens. That's been true for a long, long period of time. Mm-hmm. In terms of how many kids are using, I think it's been fairly stable over the last 10 years for alcohol and marijuana. But what has changed in just the last few years is a tremendous increase in what is known as vaping, mm-hmm. where a child will take a substance like marijuana or nicotine, and they'll use an instrument that turns it into a vapor and then inhale it. In the last 3 years, there has been a tremendous increase in the number of adolescents who are vaping nicotine and marijuana. For example, 3 years ago, the percentage of high school seniors that were vaping marijuana was 9%. Today, it's 22%.
Wow.
The percentage of high school seniors 3 years ago that were vaping nicotine was 18%. Today, it's 34%. Mm. So there has been a dramatic increase in this vaping among adolescents. And there's been research from the University of Rochester Medical Center, which came out, which shows that kids and adults who are vaping are starting to report difficulty in concentrating and remembering. Oh, so wow. Parents need to be aware that this vaping is a tremendous way in which kids are getting their nicotine and their marijuana. Cigarette smoking is at an all-time low, but I think what's going on is kids are switching from smoking cigarettes to vaping nicotine, and now they're starting to vape marijuana as well.
And it's such a, sorry, just get a little tongue-tied here, of with marijuana becoming legal, that opens a whole other door of conversation of sort of changing the whole way that substance abuse counseling is seen and intervened, correct?
It is, and I think the missing component to this is, yes, marijuana is legal in more and more states for adults, not for mm-hmm. adolescents. And the difference being the brain. You know, an adolescent's mm-hmm. brain, as you know, is in the process of developing mm-hmm. and maturing and doesn't get fully developed until around age 24 or 25. So it's a much different situation for an adolescent to be vaping a substance or using a substance like marijuana when their brain is developing, as opposed to an adult who has a fully developed brain.
Right.
And many of the teenagers that I worked with at Menninger Clinic were smoking marijuana multiple times a day. Mm. And when I asked them to help me understand why they were smoking marijuana so much, the number one answer that came back was, it helps me with my anxiety. Mm. So for many kids, not all kids, for many kids, there may be an underlying issue that they're using a substance to medicate, like anxiety mm-hmm. or depression, mm-hmm. or maybe being bullied at school that the parents didn't know about. And when the psychological tests came back on these kids, whose IQs were very high, they were above average to superior, when the psychological tests came back, the neuropsychological tests came back, we found that the processing speed of the brain was below average. Mm. We found that their short-term memory was impaired and their motivation wasn't very good. Right. So those are some examples of what we're seeing when we dig below the surface of how marijuana is interacting with the developing brain.
Right. And it's also brings up the question, like you're saying, is with any medication, you want the parent to be informed. The parent wants to be able to ask questions. They want to know what's going on, whether it's legal or not. They want to know that this is the best medical intervention for their child.
Right. You want the best for your child and right. you want the best intervention for your child. Right. right.
And it's interesting, I would like to learn more about vaping because I feel like it's just sort of taken over. you see it often. It's I saw this one commercial where, you know, you see these three kids and they're talking about these different flavors, right? Do you want blueberry or bubblegum yeah. and all these different things, but they're talking and you think they're talking about like ice cream or something, but it's all about vaping, right?
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to see, you know, when I was growing up, we had Joe Camel. Right. I remember Joe Camel and the cigarettes of, yeah. oh, you want to be this cool cowboy. And they got rid of that. But now you see, you know, kids are being targeted with these really delicious flavors that, oh, this is just vape. This is just, you know, smoke. But as you're saying, there's usually more to the story than just vapors.
Yeah, it's very clever marketing, you know, to appeal mm-hmm. to kids with the various flavors and the various ways in which they can use these substances. But you know, when you start to put these substances into a developing brain, you can run the risk of doing some harm.
Right. And one of the other substances I haven't seen was K2. I don't know if you saw that a lot in Texas.
You know, that is really something that was going on quite a while ago, K2 Spice. Okay. Yep. You know, I think, you know, that is a fad that sort of has diminished significantly. Mm-hmm. I think it had a period of time when it was very popular because you could pick it up just about anywhere. Mm-hmm. And finally, some of the regulations started to tighten down a little bit on it. It's not one of the drugs that I think kids are getting heavily into anymore. Okay. It's still out there. Right. Parents need to be at least aware of what it is. But I don't think you find it very widely being used.
Okay. I agree with you. I've heard more about it a few years ago. Every once in a while, actually just in the last month, I've actually been having conversations about it. So that's why it was on my mind. The other piece too that I remember looking at with your book is non-substance related addiction, which I think gets the back shelf a lot of there are a lot of different addictive behaviors that don't necessarily have to do with substances.
It is. And we refer to those as process addictions. And I have a chapter in my book on process addictions. There's chemical addictions, which are the alcohol and the drugs. And then there's process addictions, which tend to be more behavioral in nature, but can carry the same type of consequences, negative consequences, as the chemical addictions like alcohol and drugs. Mm-hmm. They also have the same reaction in the brain in that they increase dopamine, which gives the person the pleasurable feeling that they're having. So some examples are eating disorders, mm-hmm. Self-injury, gaming, cell phone use. All of these can become compulsive disorders. And many of them, like the cell phone use and some of the gaming, can be very disruptive to a family.
Yes, I if we could jump into that a little bit, because I actually deal with a lot of that on the adult side of how do I parent my child who, you know, the teenager or the 10-year-old or the 6-year-old who has a meltdown when the parent takes the device away to have dinner or to charge the device. There's this eruption that I think parents have no idea what to do with.
Yeah. And, excuse me. That eruption tells you how compulsive this has become, right. You know, to the child, how they literally cannot be separated from it without going, you know, ballistic, so to speak. Right. And parents need to learn to deal with this and to set reasonable limits. Because if they don't, they run the risk of this really becoming compulsive behavior and getting worse. And then you're going to have more and more of these outbursts and more of these reactions.
And it's hard because I hear parents say, you know, what do I do when we're in a long car ride? This is what quiets them. This is the only thing that relaxes them. I need quiet time for myself, or I need quality time with my partner. Yeah. And it's a pandemic, so we can't go anywhere. So how do we, you know, it's like the devil, you know, the rock between the hard place of how do we get our kids in a world of technology where they're now getting them at school, the laptops or the different devices? Yeah. What would you recommend for parents? Because it is completely different in so many aspects than in the substance, the chemical, because they're exposed to it so much more.
Yeah, I think as a parent, you have to set reasonable expectations and boundaries that you can enforce. And the child needs to know very clearly what these boundaries are. If you don't want your child using their cell phone during family dinner time, then you tell them you're not allowed to use your phone during family dinner time. If you want your child to get their homework done before they play their video games, then you make that very clear. You will do your homework first. So part of this is setting reasonable expectations that the child is aware of. I think sometimes they get into this conflict because neither the child nor the parent has set or knows about these reasonable expectations. What's the guidelines? What are the rules? Mm-hmm. If you have no rules, it's hard to enforce them.
Right. So. And kids crave that structure, don't they?
They do crave it, you know. They won't tell you that, you know.
But that's what we see the acting out of. They're looking for those boundaries. They're looking for the compassion and the guidance, but the the structure and the direction from parents.
Yeah. And the other thing, kids take their cues from parents. Mm-hmm. So if the kids see their parents who are on their iPhones, you know, 24/7, kids begin to see, well, that's okay. You know, my parents are on the phone all the time looking up things on the internet. Must be okay for me too.
Right.
So part of it comes to modeling the behavior that you want.
And do you have any suggestions where for parents who struggle with that? Because I'm just thinking of people that I've worked with where they're just exhausted.
Yeah, it can be exhausting, especially if you're in a constant battle with your child over their iPhone use, their cell phone use, or the video gaming.
Right.
It's like every single day you go through this fight and it becomes exhausting.
Right.
And some parents just say, it's not worth the fight.
Yes.
The problem with that is it is worth the fight, because right. if you don't put some control on this, it's very likely to get worse and right. even more out of control.
Right. And one of the discussions I had with a parent once, I said, I validating the exhaustion, validating the pain and just how tiring it is to be a parent, especially in our world today.
Yeah.
But the question that I posed was, if you're not going to parent your child, who will?
If you're not going to parent your child, probably somebody on the street, another kid, another,
right.
another person out there is going to take on that role. Right. And it may not be the role that you would choose for your child.
Right, right. And then you lose even more connection.
And then you're going to deal with it. You're going to deal with the effects of that down the road.
Rick, I just wanted to share that Kim joined in on it with our in the chat today. So she just was wondering, asked a question about the dual treatment facilities that, like you were saying, that you were working with. So
yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that. Is with the facility you're working at, is that a common practice that you see in Texas and the different clinics? Because I know in our area, we definitely have some great clinics, but there's definitely a limitation of resourcing in our community.
Well, that is such an excellent question, because for some kids, not all kids, but for some kids, they will end up with what we refer to as a dual diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have a substance use disorder and a mental health disorder. For example, you might have a child who's smoking marijuana and they have severe anxiety, or maybe it's depression. So you have a child who has both the substance use disorder and the mental health issue. When those are both diagnosed, it's very important that child get treatment for both. I can't treat the marijuana and ignore the anxiety, because if I do, the chances of that kid staying off marijuana are slim to none.
Mm-hmm.
So in cases where you have a dual diagnosis, you will be looking at treatment that treats both of the disorders.
Mm-hmm.
And you will be looking for a facility that is a dual diagnosis facility. In other words, a treatment program that can treat all of the diagnoses, the substance abuse, as well as the mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And many, many treatment programs offer that. But I have a section in my book that talks about, how do you know what a good evidence-based treatment program looks like?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the questions you as a parent should ask a provider?
Mm-hmm.
Because in the middle of a crisis, you might not think of some of the questions that you should be asking. So I put in a list of questions that parents can ask a provider. And also there's a chapter on, how do I know what a good treatment program looks like?
Mm-hmm.
How do I know what an evidence-based treatment looks like?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a chapter that guides them through that too.
Right. Is there any information or tips that you could share from that? And I know the book is a great resource of just something maybe you could share with our viewers tonight that you would recommend, how they would know or...
Well, many times when you go through the process of getting the assessments done that I recommend in my book, and you will need more than just an addictions assessment,
mm-hmm.
but I have a chapter on assessments that guides parents in terms of what assessments should I get. Many times when you go through that assessment process, the people who are doing the assessments are very capable at making referrals for you based upon the assessment and the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you want to use as your cancer guide map. What are the professionals suggesting is the best treatment for my child? And where are those best treatments located? Mm-hmm. Now, as a parent, you're not going to know that, okay? Mm-hmm. Because you don't know about all these treatment options. You don't know where these places are. They could be anywhere. Mm-hmm. So you rely on the professionals, the therapists, the counselors, the social workers, the psychiatrists, the ones who are doing the assessments and telling you what the diagnoses are, and many times can give you options in terms of what treatment is available and where the best treatment is for the particular situation that your child is dealing with.
Right. And one of the things too that I've seen in the clinics, at least in our area, is they're amazing advocates of dealing with insurance or helping you find what's covered or coming with a sliding scale fee. There's that understanding of, like you were saying at the beginning of our discussion, is there a lot of roadblocks? Let's figure out how we can make bridges to go over those so you can get the help that you need.
And that's exactly right. And many treatment facilities have staff that are dedicated to helping families get the most out of their insurance. Right. So you don't have to really fight the battles yourself. Right. They have people on staff that are willing to go to the insurance companies and fight those battles for you.
Right. And I think, too, one of the other components I see that I'd be interested in hearing your perspective of is one of the questions that I've actually heard from parents is, how will this affect their future? Especially if we're talking about diagnosing, if we're talking about recommendations, if they have specific professions that their kids are interested in, especially like the military or different legal components. Have you ever encountered that where they're afraid, all right, I need to get my child the help, but I don't want them to have a diagnosis?
No, I haven't had anyone do that. But, usually by the time I see them, the situation is so severe and so serious, they want a diagnosis and they want treatment and they want action. Okay. And the other thing is, adolescents basically are protected. In other words, especially when it comes to substance abuse, that's right. Protected information. Right. That is not information that an employer would or a school would have access to. It's under their medical records. Right. It's under the confidentiality that we have for medical records. And substance abuse is even more protected than medical records. So right. I would say to a family, I wouldn't be too concerned about this.
Right. I've seen that where I think it's sort of the logistical piece of how do I handle a crisis because they can't deal with the panic of the crisis.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And then it goes down to that question of, well, if you don't have the diagnosis, your child can't get the help that they need.
Yeah.
You're not going to have a future to worry about if this gets worse.
Yeah, because you're not going to get treatment because right. Without a diagnosis, you don't know what kind of treatment you need.
Right, exactly. And then you're not going to get the coverage.
Right, exactly.
And the support that you need.
Right. And that's important. Mm-hmm.
Hey, so when you're dealing with this over, over two decades, what are some things that you've seen that have, that if you could change in the counseling world or the human service world that you see, all right, this area is really good, but this area I could see if we could tweak this or improve this. What are your experiences on this Friday night?
If you wanted to make a significant difference, if you wanted to make a real difference in adolescent substance abuse, you would restructure how this issue is being dealt with in schools. You'd get away from this, don't say no attitude. You'd get away from having an assembly maybe once a year where you bring in somebody who talks about this. You would get away from this attitude of telling kids, drugs are illegal. If you continue to use them, you might not graduate. Your grades are going to go down. You won't get into college and you won't get a job. Because none of that stuff means anything to these kids. Mm-hmm. They don't believe it, and it doesn't mean anything to them. Mm-hmm. So what means something? What works? What I found works is a neuroscience approach. Mm-hmm. These kids are interested in learning about their brain.
Okay.
So I would restructure the curriculum in the schools on substance abuse education so that we would start in the elementary grades. And we would start by educating kids through elementary school about the brain. Teach them about the brain. Tell them what the different parts of the brain are for. Mm-hmm. Tell them how the brain works. Emphasize the need to protect the brain. I would do that every single year through elementary school. Mm-hmm. Then when they get in junior high and high school, I would start to introduce how drugs affect the brain. You've taught them about the brain in elementary school. Mm-hmm. They know the mm-hmm. basics. Mm-hmm. Now start to introduce in junior high and high school how these drugs can affect the brain. Right. And you do that year after year. You start in elementary school and you reinforce it all the way through high school. That might make a difference.
Right. That, I love that idea. And also like pulling the, I've seen in our school systems, I think there's such great efforts and programs of really, how do we do this? Getting away from the fear factor of like, I want to scare you out of this into yeah. like you're saying the more psychoeducation of let's put this on the table and it is scary, but we're going to explain why it's scary or why it's enticing. We had one program when we were growing up where it was, you know, they would show you the substances and tell you not to do this. And, you know, all these other things. And I remember a friend of mine said, well, the only thing that ever did is make me want to try them. And I was like, so a little counterproductive there. A little counterintuitive.
Yeah, you're getting them a little too curious.
Right. Because you're also not talking about, I think, well, two components. I think we need to go into trauma a bit and talk more about that and how that's addressed and treated. But also there's, in my experience growing up, there was really no conversation about the social connectedness, I don't want to say just peer pressure, because it was, you know, if your friends are using, you're trying to fit in, it's a different component than peer pressure. It's about social connectedness and do I want to fit in? Yeah. And I think that's a different discussion than just saying, oh, the kids who use are bad, stay away from them. Because that's not the case. Yeah, in a lot of situations.
That's a good point, because many times in working with adolescents, if I talk to them about, you know, their friends, they would say to me, well, if you're asking me to give up all my friends who use a substance, I'll have nobody left. Yeah. All of my friends use. Yeah. And my reaction was, well, no, that's not what I'm asking. What I'm saying to you is there are two groups of friends. There's one group of friends that only care about you because you're using a substance with them. Right. There's another group of friends who care about you as a person. And those are the kids that are going to respect your decision to not use. The first group, they don't care. If you tell them you're not going to use, they're going to try to get you to come in and use anyway. Right. The second group of friends who care about you as a friend are going to respect your decision not to use, and they're going to help you go along with that. So no, I'm not asking you to give up all your friends. I'm asking you to associate with the friends who care about you and respect your decision to not use, and will support that decision. The rest of them, you can get rid of.
Right. And then being able to talk about that and have that be part of the treatment.
Yes, absolutely. Because important. that's a big issue absolutely. With kids.
Absolutely.
You know.
And it's not a one or done. It's an evolution. It's a constant conversation. People, well, places, and things.
It's a process of figuring out who are my real friends and who are the friends that are just using me because I smoke marijuana with them.
Right. Or I do this, or I'll drink, or I'll do all these other things. And
right.
You know, things that you're saying are putting them in harm's way.
Exactly.
One of the questions that came up in chat was, how do you feel law enforcement can help?
I think law enforcement can help by working in conjunction with the family, so that if a child is picked up with using a substance or becomes involved in the law enforcement system, mm-hmm. that law enforcement can partner with the family on what do you do next? How can we help this child? And provide a good resource for the family. Law enforcement has a responsibility to enforce the law. Mm-hmm. They have a responsibility to keep people safe. Mm-hmm. But I think I think law enforcement can play a bigger role in the school system by reinforcing the education component, not the legal component, but the education component. And I think they can be a resource for families that are struggling too, because many times, not many times perhaps, but sometimes the first introduction to a child using a substance might be through law enforcement. Mm-hmm. The child gets picked up somewhere, you know?
And or they may have seen it in friends or family or in the neighborhood or something like that.
Yeah. So I think law enforcement, you know, police officers, law enforcement officials can develop a good relationship with families and can sort of be a partner in terms of this entire treatment process. Mm-hmm.
And I've seen, just as we've talked about different backgrounds, I've seen colleagues in the law enforcement where they have been the biggest advocate for people who are struggling with addiction. And then I see the other side of the coin where they're in that old school behavior of, you know, just say no, just stop it. It's all a choice. You're choosing that power dynamic of trying to bully someone into just stopping because it's illegal, instead of having that trauma-informed, that addiction-informed care of, this isn't just one decision we're talking about. This is a multifaceted process going on.
Yeah, and it comes down to having compassion,
right,
to understanding that there is more to this than just the individual using a substance. It's, yes, having compassion. It's wanting to reach out. It's wanting to help people.
And also hopefully prevent recidivism and continued or increased substance abuse down the road. If the wound or the injury that, whether it was created before or after or during substance abuse, there's going to be some level of trauma there. And being able to say, what are we doing to help this individual get help for that? Now, I this is my experience where sometimes, as you're saying, the person continues to break the law. So the law enforcement has to do what they're doing because that's what it's there for. But I think there are so many moments that different interventions can happen before that to hopefully prevent the worst case scenarios.
Yeah, that's a good point, because there is no one intervention that fits everybody. Every situation's different, every family's different, and you have to be prepared to use the intervention that is going to be most compassionate and most effective.
Right. And you know, one of the things that popped into my head too, that when we were talking about what law enforcement can do, what changes we can make, I also wanted to go back to a little bit of more of when someone's in treatment, the importance of the parent or family being involved, in the sense of being able to ask questions when the child's in treatment.
Absolutely. And at Menninger, that was the role of the social worker.
Right.
The social worker had the primary responsibility of communicating with the family, getting the psychosocial history done, and keeping the family informed on the progress of treatment, because it's very important that families become a partner in the treatment process.
Right. And also, I think it also teaches the child, I'm not alone in this. Like, we might hate this, but if they're coming, they're asking questions, they're having conversations with my counselor in an appropriate way. It's not about divulging everything, but it's about being involved. I think that adds another level of healing to it and support.
It does. It gives the child the feeling that they're not alone,
right,
that their family hasn't abandoned them,
right,
that their family is as much involved in this treatment as they are.
Yes. And when I see, and I know every family is different and some are healthier than others, but when I've worked with teenagers in this situation before, one of the questions I always get from parents is, you know, they'll say, I don't want you to tell me all the personal stuff. I just want to know if there's anything else that I can do. Is there anything that I should know?
Yeah.
And to me, as a clinician, I see that as an opportunity of bringing them into the treatment of, you know, also validating their fears and letting them know they're not alone, and they're doing an amazing job as a parent, because this is scary as hell.
It is. And you're absolutely right. They need to know that they're not alone.
Yes.
They need to know that there is somebody there that understands the crisis that they're going through, the emotions, right, that they're going through, and somebody there that they trust, that they can talk to about these.
Right.
Because if they're all alone, it's going to be a much more difficult road.
Right. And then you see that the domino effect too of the shame, the fear, the guilt of the parent doesn't want to divulge what's going on with the child. You know, where do they get that support? Where, because it's also, you know, it's okay to be angry, to be frustrated, to be, yeah, you know, scared, all of the different emotions. And if the parents or the guardians don't have a place to process that, it's going to come out on the kid.
Absolutely. And it's very important that if a parent is going through this process, that they get help for themselves, that they have somebody that can be there for them, some support system that they can build around themselves. Maybe it's a counselor, maybe it's a therapist, maybe it's a close friend, maybe it's a support group, but parents need help and support as well.
Yes. And I think too, one of the other questions that we're seeing is, you know, maybe some law enforcement or different people need more training. And I think it has to be an ongoing conversation for all of us, because we're seeing an increase in substance abuse, and we're seeing it younger, and we're seeing addictions traits come out in younger and younger. Mm-hmm. And how that affects us as society and as a community, of being able to know, I constantly am going to need to learn more about this because it's constantly changing.
Yes, it is constantly evolving, and it's right, constantly changing. And, right, and that is something that we're going to continue to see.
Right. And I think too, another aspect that's important is when we find someone, you know, who deals with this with anger, with that fear mentality, or doesn't want to acknowledge it, there really has to be that conversation of, you know, what is your resistance to being able to deal with this in a compassionate, therapeutic way? Because banging down the door and using force doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. And that can be a real challenge to try and work with some of these parents who just want the attention focused on the kid.
Yes.
Solve the problem. I don't want to talk about me. I don't want to talk about the family. I brought the kid to treatment. Right. You deal with it. And, right, and that can make treatment so much more complicated and probably much longer than what it needs to be. Right. And you also have to look at, what's this environment going to be like that this kid after treatment's going to return to?
Right.
You know,
right.
So it's extremely important that the family be involved in this treatment process, and many times needs treatment itself.
Right. And sometimes also that's when it's, you know, dipping your toe into it of where the substance use is in the house. So we find the kid drinking, but then you find out, oh yeah, because that's what I see mom and dad do every night. But no, yeah, one wants to have that discussion of, you know, kids do look up to their parents. They're gonna continue the behaviors.
Yeah, and the parents say, well, it's okay for me to drink, but I don't want my kid to drink. I don't right, understand why he's drinking, right, and the parents are drinking every day.
Yeah. You know, and so, I see that behavior or that mentality more and more of, my child should do what I say, yeah, instead of educating the child of, this is why I'm saying what I'm saying. That piece of communication and education is, I don't want to say lacking, but I feel it needs to be increased in the communication of families.
It does, because I think the attitude of, well, do it because I told you to do it and I'm the parent and that's good enough. Right. That's not good enough for the kid, because the kid wants a rational explanation of what the rule is. Sometimes they're not arguing against the rule. They're arguing because they don't understand the rule.
Right.
Or they don't understand why the rule is there. Right. So if parents can just sit down with them and have a discussion as to, okay, this is why this rule is in place. And right, give the child a chance to dialogue and discuss it. You're not, yes, going to change the rule. The rule's the rule. Yep. But you can go a long way towards helping the child understand the reason for the rule.
Right. And I think too, and I love your opinion, Rick, of, you know, I've met so many amazing people who have battled addiction and mental health, and they're in recovery, and they're living their recovery. And then they have children, and they have the most beautiful approach of being able to talk to their kids about, you know, in an age-appropriate way, of how addiction and mental health affects the family.
Yes.
And yeah, I find that is so empowering for children. As you're saying, it's that education, it's that respect and that dignity of, this isn't some mystery. There is a physiological, biological, and behavioral component here that we need to educate you on so you're safe and healthy in this world.
Absolutely. And you can use your own experiences if you have them. You can use your own consequences if you face them. And like you said, age appropriate, but be able to have that discussion with your child so that they can begin to see that there's a lot to this dynamic of substance abuse.
Right. And I compare it a lot to medical issues as well. Like I have diabetes in my family. So if I had children, I would definitely be mindful of, hey, this runs in our family. This isn't a fear tactic. It's an educational piece. So we can make sure that we're all healthy and in making the best decisions for our bodies.
That's right. And part of that is just simply communicating to the child that there is a genetic component to any addiction. No different than any other disease. If you have hypertension in your family, if you have diabetes in your family, if you're a woman and you have breast cancer in your family, well, what does that mean? It means you're at higher risk. Doesn't mean you're going to get the disease. It just means you're at higher risk. Right. Well, the same is true for addiction. And I think children can begin to see in an age-appropriate way that if that genetic component is in their family, they need to appreciate that they may be at a little bit more risk than somebody else. Right. And just knowing that can be powerful.
Right. And I think that would can go into what you're saying, if we could revitalize the education system in so many different ways, not just in school, also in treatment itself. When I know when I was in grad school, we had one class on substance abuse, and it was more of an elective. And I took it because I was interested in it, you know, different things. But I'm amazed of how many people I've met in the field who have an aversion to addictions, to addiction-related issues, and an aversion to trauma. And my question is, like, so what are you doing? What are you treating? Like, you don't want to talk about trauma. You don't want to talk about addiction. So what are you actually working on? Because almost everyone I've seen, whether they're struggling with an addiction, the mom, the grandmother, the best friend, their buddy at school, someone is struggling with these things.
Absolutely. And I think this is a good question. You know, what are you dealing with if you're shying away from those issues? Because those are very serious issues that if you're in any type of practice, you're going to come across almost on a daily basis.
Yes, absolutely. When I hear, you know, clinicians, I've seen some really disheartening comments and judgmental in the human service field against people who struggle with this. It's like, do you not know what fields we're in here? I mean, we're helping people, you know, and I think that's one of the pieces too. The question about what someone in law enforcement can do is, I think it's across the board of, you also have to do the work on your stuff. You have to know your issues. If you're struggled with addiction, if you've suffered at the hand of addiction or lost someone to this, you have to heal those wounds, because that's going to bleed through into whoever you work with.
Yeah. And I think it also raises the issue of the stigma that's associated with addiction and even mental health. There still is a stigma there, much more so than I think what we realize. And I think that frames society's point of view on people who are addicts. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it doesn't lead to having a lot of compassion for them, right, which is unfortunate, because that also relates to a lack of treatment.
Yes. I think when you stop seeing the person as a person, that's when you got to backtrack, get some supervision, get some therapy, do the work, because it doesn't matter what they're walking in with. They're still the person, and they still deserve dignity, respect, and all of the options that we can offer them.
They still deserve, you know, respect, compassion, and the best treatment that we can provide.
Yes. Yes. Very true. Well, so let me ask, you know, as we wind down today, because I could really go on for hours talking to you, Rick, because this is so, it's so interesting, it's so important, and I think I could just spend hours doing that with you. How could people find you, find your book, share it with a friend? How can they connect with you if they would like to?
Well, the book, again, the title is The Addicted Child, A Parent's Guide to Adolescent Substance Abuse, and there's a workbook that accompanies it. Both are available on Amazon.
Okay.
Or you can go to the book's website, which is helptheaddictedchild.com, helptheaddictedchild.com. Okay. When you get to the website, you can read endorsements and reviews and a sample chapter. There'll be a link that will take you directly to Amazon where you can buy the book as a Kindle or as a paperback. Okay. And you can also buy, if you're interested, the parent workbook. And there's also a link where you can send me a message or ask me a question as well. So really the easiest way is just to go to helptheaddictedchild.com.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I do have one last question for you.
Sure.
As we wind down today, one of the questions I like to ask is there one thing that you would like the audience to walk away with from our conversation tonight?
Yeah. I want them to walk away with the idea that there is hope out there, that treatment does work. Early intervention is important. Don't become paranoid about this subject. Don't shy away from it. Knowledge is power. Learn as much as you can. And if you find that you are involved with this situation, you have a child that you discover is using a substance, use the resources that are there for you. Intervene as soon as you can, because we know treatment works. Mm-hmm. And you and your family can get through this and recover.
Okay. Well, I love that. Thank you so much. The hope message, I think, is so important in that they're not alone. So thank you so much, Rick, for coming on Friday Night Feels. Everyone, thank you for listening and watching and supporting it. Just a reminder, we'll be on the YouTube after and the Facebook. And if you want to listen to the podcast version, it's on my social media. You can see that as well. I hope you all have a beautiful weekend. And we'll see you in a couple weeks here in the next Friday Night Feels. Have a good night, everyone.